Welcome to Inspiring STEM's podcast program highlighting innovations in scientific publishing and science communications. We are interviewing key opinion leaders and organizations working to advance and quite often to disrupt the status quo. My name is Martin Delahunty and I will be your host. In this week's episode, I'm chatting with Romy Beard, a publishing consultant with 17 years' experience and specializing in publishing relations and content licensing on behalf of publishers, aggregators, libraries, and consortia and technology companies. She is currently working on a long-term project with the open access management platform Chronos Hub and recently completed a project with JISC on the new UK Research Innovation Open Access Policy. Romy holds a first-class honours degree in English language and literature from the University of Glasgow and a postgraduate MA in English literature from the University of Warwick. A very warm welcome, Romy, to the programme.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to learning a bit about Chronos Hub, can you tell us about your background and how you became involved in publishing in this great business?
Yeah, sure. It kind of was a little bit by chance, really. During my master's at Warwick, I was kind of thinking about what did I want to do. I considered doing a PhD. I considered going into teaching, but then I also did placements at publishing companies, and I really enjoyed that. So I decided I wanted to work in publishing. I applied for a ton of jobs that had the word assistant added to them and didn't get any interviews. But then I got an interview for a sales administrator job that I hadn't actually applied for. And what happened is that I'd applied for a marketing assistant job in the online products department at Oxford University Press. And the person managing the marketing department was also in charge of sales, and they were hiring a sales administrator, and she'd passed my CV on to the sales manager, who looked at it. And I'd worked in a bookshop. I'm originally from Luxembourg, so speak lots of languages, thought that's great for sales. And I got this interview, and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but Ian Hames, he thought I was going to be great at it, so I thought let's give it a shot, and I really enjoyed it. So I joined the Oxford University online products department. At the time, there was only 5 products. So it was the Oxford English Dictionary, Grove Reference, Grove Music, Grove Art, Oxford Reference. So it was all humanities products that I was quite interested in. So it was, organizing demos. And at the start, it was admin work. But then I got more and more into sales and kind of worked my way up there. And then I became quite interested in the ebook side. I mean, Oxford Scholarship launched, there was a lot of discussion around ebooks. Journals were already online, but for books that were still, the beginning really. So I was quite interested in that. And then transitioned to work for eBrewery. I actually followed the person that hired me, Oxford University Press, Ian Hames. They were looking for someone to manage their sales for Europe. So that was actually a great time working for a tech startup, same as I'm doing now for Chronos Hub, based in California. So I got to go over there a few times a year. And yeah, that was still like the start of the transition from print to e. So a lot of conversations with libraries about that, transitioning their collections from print collections to electronic. Then new business models came in, like patron-driven acquisition and short-term loan and that thing. So it's quite an exciting time. And then eBrewery actually got acquired by ProQuest and merged into one with other products like EBL. And around the same time, I was pregnant and I kind of had started segueing a little bit into the publisher relations side. So content acquisition more than sales. So I worked for the next 3 years with publishers to really have discussions with them about transitioning their print to electronic and being able to sell it through eBrewery, because we had a lot of customers in German-speaking countries, for example, who wanted German books. So I worked a lot with German publishers and other UK and European publishers to get them to digitize their book content to be able to sell it online. So that was it was less travel for me personally. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to get out of sales, because I then had a kid. I didn't want to be away for too long. So I still did the book fairs, which was really intense, but less on like kind of a monthly basis. It was more, you can count it on one hand rather than twice a month.
you've been there as part of two of the major changes over the last sort of 10, 15, 20 years, which is, you know, consolidation amongst the publishing service providers and publishers, and also the transformation from print to digital. And I think it's always interesting to look back and just think about how journals took that leap forward in advance of books, and books then have taken quite some time to make that similar transformation. Why do you think that is?
I don't really know.
It's a hard one to answer. Yeah.
Yeah. I think as a book form, it's maybe a little bit more difficult to go electronic. I think journals did the electronic earlier on, and then obviously you still have some journals that now lag and have print, whereas others are online only, and it makes them, you know, obviously more searchable. There's like tons of advantages over that. I don't know why journals went e before books. I think at the start of my career, I was kind of avoiding journals a little bit, to be honest, because I was into the like kind of databases, ebooks, and then like since it changed, I've been looking less at what books have been doing, more focused on journals.
But your background and working through that process of consolidation and you know, working with different service providers and the stakeholders that you're currently working with at that time, also going through a major transition and trying to manage change. I mean, nothing's different currently than it was 10 or 15 years ago. We still have consolidation and change and challenges for those stakeholders within scholarly publishing. So you seem very well positioned to have that holistic view to help manage those difficult changes. And they are very difficult changes.
Absolutely. And I think now the transition that we're talking about now, obviously, is in relation to journals, you know, pay to publish versus pay to read, which is a different one. And in terms of just how am I going to read it? Am I going to read it electronically? Can I search it? So I think that is a very different conversation. And also maybe that transition has kind of happened more from the top down, hasn't it? We've not actually asked people so much, would you like to do this? Whereas I think the kind of the print to e-transition in terms of accessing content, there's a lot of it come from the users as well, like authors wanting to read digitally, wanting to search, wanting to have information at their fingertips 24/7, always have a book available. And some of the early like ebooks models, like, you know, kind of really set, like try to answer that. And I know there's still challenges like around textbooks, for example, that are still being, you know, solved and solutions coming up. I think the kind of, you know, transition within open access now for journals primarily isn't so much the author that has come and said, this is a bit unfair, is it? It's been more funder-driven, consortia-driven, library-driven.
It does seem that we're solving one challenge for libraries and institutional customers and passing an even bigger challenge on to authors. And it's this, you know, moving from pay to read to pay to publish, which creates difficulties. And I know you've talked and blogged previously around the difficulty in particular with article processing charges, APC waivers. And we've had two very recent good discussions with people who are similarly trying to address those challenges. Jo Havman with Africa Archive and her Access to Perspectives consultancy, and Akil Bansal, who's a clinical doctor now working with Charity Entrepreneurship, again to address these particular challenges around inequity in the scholarly publishing system, which one part of this is the pay to publish, the article processing charges and the waivers that are available within Africa and lower middle income countries, but don't necessarily solve the problem. So that, what has your experience been with lower middle income countries and Africa in addressing this challenge?
Yeah, so I mean, to answer that, I'll backtrack a little bit, because after I worked for Ebree, I moved on to work for an organization called EIFL, Electronic Information for Libraries, a charity based in Lithuania. that works with developing and transition economy countries and consortia libraries, mostly in about 40 countries. And originally, my position there was really focused on negotiating with publishers for affordable, discounted, sometimes free access to paywalled content. And that really included all sorts of content, journal databases, ebook collections, everything. But then the last 3 years or so, the focus on journals became more important as we also started to negotiate publishing conditions like APC discounts, waivers, and read and publish agreements. Because obviously in that area specifically, we saw that this transition was going to hit those authors really hard because a lot of them are unfunded. They don't have any money to pay for APCs. They can't even afford to pay for subscriptions. So the response from EIFL was to negotiate those agreements, to have conditions in place. And a lot of publishers have their own APC waiver and discount schemes, but there's a number of issues with those because sometimes countries transition from one to the other. They're not very well communicated. There's not always a title list available. So that was the response really as an organization for EIFL. And that was quite interesting getting involved in all of that. And that's really where I then, you know, became more knowledgeable about the way and the transition for journals specifically. I think, you know, the issues that you mentioned within this change in scholarly publishing system from pay to read to pay to publish, obviously there is an issue with affordability. As I mentioned, a lot of these authors, even if you get a 50% discount on a $2,000 APC, you still can't afford to pay it. So that is addressed through agreements, but also obviously policy decisions from publishers at the top, you know, deciding what are they going to allow, negotiating with consortia, funders striking agreements directly with consortia or libraries to take some of that burden away from the author to pay. And that's also one of the reasons for the, you know, read and publish agreement, transitional agreement, whatever you want to call them, to make sure the author doesn't have to pay. So it's seamless for them and there shouldn't really be that change. They can access everything and they can publish and there shouldn't be any burden on them. During my time at EIFL towards the end of last year, I did a bit of digging into the data and articles that had been published through various agreements. And it was quite interesting when we looked at that because we saw that there was what you can call missed OA articles that really should have been OA. They were even eligible for a waiver, but the authors didn't claim them. And that was sometimes due to communication, but a lot of times, and I think in the case of one particular publisher, it was a workflow issue. The author had to email the editor to get the waiver. And I think that's how I become interested in the technology side of thing that CornerSub addresses, the workflow issue, how you can make things smoother for authors by taking away these like technology issues. So as an author from a developing country, when you submit an article, should it be automatically recognized that you get 100% discount or 50% discount?
It's complex for authors, and the challenges, you shouldn't be underestimated if authors are dealing with two or three journals. I had a project about 5 years ago where I was retrospectively, on behalf of a client, seeking open access for articles that had been published behind a firewall. And just the process of going to, in that case, to 15, 20 publishers, just really brought home to me the complexity and the differentiation between approaches from each individual publisher. And it was mostly a manual process of trying to extract the information necessary for me to do that particular project. So for an author, again, navigating that with a publisher is always going to be challenging unless it's made easy, and made easy at their institutional level as well, taking that burden away from the individuals.
Yeah, I think retrospective away is like even, you know, you kind of, ideally you don't want to get to that stage. You want to make it away just in time. Were you able to solve the issues with the publishers to get them to make the articles away?
Ultimately, yes. We actually produced a poster and it was published. So it was the work I did on behalf of Shire Pharmaceuticals. So we published that as a poster for the International Society of Medical Publication Professionals. But it just, again, brought out to me the challenge for me as a, you know, relatively experienced publisher, knowing the publishers I was working with, to thinking, putting myself in the shoes of an author trying to navigate that complexity and and I'd be thinking, well, it might be just easier for me to publish behind a subscription firewall because there's no payments involved. So taking that burden away is, you know, really important. So what other challenges do you see currently in scholarly publishing from your experience?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about challenges around affordability and policy. And I think, although I think the intentions are good with things like funded policy, they are still challenging for authors. We see that like things like agreements are very effective. There's like, what now, 500,000 articles published, open access through agreements. If you look at the ESAC Market Watch, and some of that is due to funder policies, but they are, I think, very challenging still for authors to figure out, you know, where can I publish? Is this included in an agreement? Is this compliant with my funder? Is my EPC going to reimburse? There's a lot for that on the end user before we even get to the actual kind of during the submission process of, you know, where do I send my invoice? So I think that is still a challenge.
And maybe just thinking about funders and the work that you did for UK Research and Innovation recently, did that policy take into account prior experiences from UKRI fund recipients, previous authors? Did they take into consideration making the process easier for the author? Was that a consideration?
I believe so. I wasn't so involved with the actual policy. I was more involved with actually talking to publishers to making them aware of what, you know, routes they have. And this was just a short project I did working with JISC in terms of publisher outreach, but there was a whole team at JISC that looks at data and reporting. And I do know that they have in their conversations with publishers as well, discussions about workflow, because obviously if you want to be compliant through like the agreement route, for example, you have to deliver as a publisher on certain things like data reporting, author recognition, I think is one of the things that is being talked about as part of the agreements as well. But then ultimately, I think it's up to every publisher, like very small publishers might be able to catch authors from certain institutions through a manual process. But obviously, depending on how much away you have, it's not scalable, right? It's being done manually.
So what was the feedback from publishers to the new policy generally?
Quite mixed. I personally was more involved with the long tail of publishers. So a lot of US publishers or publishers that had very little UKI funded articles. So obviously for them to say, I'm going to look at an agreement with JISC, wasn't really, you know, worth it in a way, because if it's just a handful, maybe even just one article a year. So most of those agreed to be compliant through both the green by exception route. They say if you come and you're funded by UKI, we'll let you deposit your AAM under CC BY license in an embargo, without embargo, in a repository. So that was kind of like the almost like the last resort. And there's a few who said, actually, we're not changing it. This is just how it is. Tough, but very mixed. Some publishers are very open and they want to be very keen to comply, are very open to do agreement and see as an opportunity. Small and big publishers, and you see some small publishers that have done really, really well with things like read and publish agreements. They see, you know, massive uptake in a way. They're committed to flipping journals. I think it depends really... I think it depends on the subject area. I'm finding out now more. There's some very niche publishers that aren't affected by it, where OA is not in demand at all and it's not been a concern for them. Whereas others, they just really want to do it. Like they have the drive and they believe in it as a company, and that kind of supersedes that in a way. So I think some of it is culture at the publisher. Some of it is to do with what subjects they publish in.
Yeah, and that would be my experience as well. There's just kind of a mixed bag of experiences. But I do feel that even in the last 2-3 years, the publishers have advanced in terms of their capability and knowledge in managing the very complex arrangements, either transformative deals, read and publish, subscribe to open, all of the various flavors of transformative type deals. Things have improved and they're going to improve, I think, further. But maybe getting on now to talk about streamlining the open access process, which, you know, as we move forward, there's a level of understanding and a capability by publishers and other stakeholders to manage it, but then we have an increasing level of complexity as well. So streamlining the process for all the stakeholders seems to be a major challenge and an opportunity then for a workflow tool to step in. And there are a number that are out there, but you're doing work now for Kronos Hub, and it seems like that is the mission, is to help streamline that open access management for all the stakeholders. So maybe you could explain a little bit about Kronos Hub and what it's offering.
Absolutely. And yeah, you've got the tagline there. So that is the mission is really to make the author journey easier during the 08 publication process. And that really, that the author is at the center of what Kronos Hub tries to do, and therefore works with publishers, funders, and institutions, because they're all, in contact with the author, and you need to look at the problem kind of from all angles, and they're all connected. Personally, I work mostly with publishers in this role in terms of publisher relations and business development. But yeah, as a journey, that problem really starts pre-submission, trying to make it really clear to authors, where they can publish, which journals are available, are they compliant with their funders. So this is where Kronos Hub has the what we call the Journal Finder, which is a pre-submission tool, which can be either used by institutions across like all publishers, or publish a branded version. Like we have one set up for the American Chemical Society, where you see only the ACS journals. And as an author, you can then select your institution, you can select your funder, and you can see which of the journals are compliant or what publishing options are available to you in that respect. So that's trying to address the issue of, clarification, really, pre-submission. But then the confusion continues, usually like post-acceptance, when as an author you get a message saying, hurrah, your manuscript has been accepted. Now go on to the next step, which is, you've probably already indicated whether you want to publish open access, but that's when then you would get the bill. And what Kronos Hub does is an APC, like OA processing and APC billing and collection solution for publishers. So trying to make it really easy for authors so they can see, yes, I'm eligible for getting my APC paid through an agreement, because we take into account institutional affiliation. We would know which agreements a publisher has. And then as an author, you still have a choice to opt out. I think that's one of the key things also what we talked about in terms of the challenges. We really try and make OA the default as the author. So that's a really clear choice. That's what I want to be choosing. And it's not like a button somewhere at the bottom that says, do you want to choose OA? So we want to make OA as a default to increase OA. And I think a lot of it is down to technology. It's nice to have these agreements. It's great to have them in place, but making sure they really clear to authors and what the benefit is for them. So in terms of the workflow, that is one of the things that visually works quite well for the author and taking them through the process. If they pay themselves by credit card, if they want to have the APC sent to an institution, that sort of thing. But then we also address the kind of reporting issue. A lot of consortia libraries, they want to see, where do my affiliated authors publish? Even for models like Subscribe to Open, I've had some conversations with publishers that, they want to give data to their subscribing institution to see where do their authors publish with them. Not just do they publish open access, but also do they publish closed access. So as a publisher, you can provide logins to all your institutional customers. Whether they subscribe or not doesn't actually matter, because all the data goes through the system and you always have an affiliation as an author. So one of the things we say at Kronos Hub is to publishers, is what we say is, we don't hold your data hostage. It's your data. If you want to make it accessible to anyone you like, you can do that, and we're all for it, because I think it makes this whole transition easier, as everyone is kind of, has the data at their fingertips and can play around with it.
So to use, much of the discussion at the moment around creating software solutions and workflow tools to manage the open science, open access process is dependent on application of metadata and persistent identifiers, for example, ORCID. Is that also part of the Kronos Hub approach?
Yes, absolutely. It's all about persistent identifiers. I mean, it's about automating the process, but that doesn't work if you don't use persistent identifiers that you use throughout the system. So we have a lot of integrations with peer review systems like Scholar One, Editorial Manager, and obviously there the exchange of information is key, that we use the same persistent identifiers, and that includes ORCID ID for authors, but also on the institutional level, Ringgold, Rohr, ISNI, to pass the information back and forth, and especially for agreement recognition, because the way it works is that a publisher provides us with a list of agreements that I have and lists the institutions, and sometimes publishers work with Ringgold, others work with Rohr or Grid, and we use a mapping system so we can map one onto the other. So regardless which system they use, once we get the information through from the peer review system, it recognizes it and it creates that match. And then for the author, the experience is seamless.
The other word I didn't mention was interoperability, which you just described there with Ringgold and Rohr, etc. And clients I advise and talk with about creating solutions for publishing workflows, they no longer want end-to-end because they realize that end-to-end is just the holy grail. That's not feasible. The key requirements are that any new system should be modular, should be interoperable, should of course be, you know, cost-effective, but also has the ability to be configurable as well within that particular discrete solution. And that has definitely changed the last 5 years since I've been consulting for a number of stakeholders. I've seen that move forward to be more accepting of modular systems that can tick those boxes, interoperable. The metadata is very, very clear. Persistent identifiers that are appropriate to scholarly publishing, and the ability to be configurable and adaptable over time.
Absolutely. And that's exactly actually the approach that Kronos Hub has. It's very modular. And yes, interoperability was one of the things I wrote down. Because you need the information to pass through the system. Let me give you two examples that show really the different workflow. So on the one hand, we work with IWA, International Water Association. So for them, the author journey is actually primarily in the peer review system, in their case, Editorial Manager. So that's where the author signs the license, they submit the article. And then we have a plugin, which is, through PIDs and everything, you get almost a window that pops up that is Kronos Hub that shows the author, this is the price you'll need to pay if you get accepted. And then it goes back to EM. And again, post-acceptance, the author essentially stays in EM and just pops out to Kronos Hub to pay the APC, and then goes back to EM in their user journey. So it's exactly what you describe, but it's only that piece. So for example, for IWA, there's no license signature. It's just no license management. It's just the APC kind of quotation during submission, and then later on, post-acceptance to take the payment. Now, on the other hand, we've got Emerald, where it's really more end-to-end, still with plugins, but there the author journey is you log in to what is essentially Kronos Hub, Emerald's Kronos Hub environment. As an author, that's where you select the journal, you do the submission, the first part of the submission, and then you pop out and you get to Scholar One, where you complete the submission, you wait for acceptance, but then post-acceptance, you're back in Kronos Hub to sign the license, to delegate the payment or do the payment. So that's more kind of the end-to-end with a kind of pop out to do the peer review system, if you look at it like a research cycle. But all of that only works if we have integration set up, and there's lots of partners. Even for Emerald, we have an integration with their login server, Liblinks, to make that really seamless. And again, the integrations with EM, we don't want authors to have to log in to a new platform, So interoperability, yes, but if it's ideally it needs to be seamless, which is what we aim to deliver.
Yeah, and the other intuitive but not so easy function, which you mentioned there, again, is having the capability of single sign-on, which is not always possible with the likes of Editorial Manager and Scholar One for various reasons. And so, yeah, having that as a goal or as an offering currently is also quite a big win for any new product.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that work, that it literally you're in EM and it pops up and you don't need to log in again, or that you get as an author, you get an email notification and you click on the link and you then in the system, you don't need to log in again.
And so what's next for Kronos Hub in terms of, you know, features and functions and any new features coming up in the next year or so? What can we expect?
There is a focus generally more towards self-service to make it, you know, more affordable, but also put more the power in the hand of the people that want to manage things, especially from a publisher point of view, to be able to add journals, add agreements yourself without having to rely on someone outside to do it. But also on the institutional solution, there's also some thoughts going into that. Then continue to do integrations. We have a lot of discussions with possible partners that we think, oh, if we could use your data, we could do this and this, or a lot of some integrations, you know, kind of having discussions, but they only become implemented when we get a specific customer request. So yeah, like always switchboard integrations. If a publisher comes and says, we really want you to send the data, we'll do it. At the moment, that's not happening in that direction anyway. So we're scoping out some things like that, so we're ready to go when people come and actually make the request. And then really in terms of features, functionalities, it's the customers that drive the roadmap. So whatever's in the pipeline and people request a certain feature, if someone, you know, signs on, then we'll get it scheduled in the development plan to have it ready in time.
And do you currently have a multi-language interface?
No. I think, again, that's one of the things people sometimes ask about, and will say, yes, if your customer will do it for you. We're not going to say, you know, translate everything into French, just waiting for like a French library to come and say, yeah, we want to use it. From a publisher view, I don't think we've had that request, not that I'm aware of anyway.
It would have to be a big potential customer to make that kind of change for any kind of product, because I'm thinking about China.
China, I guess, could be a big one that is then of value, not just to the person making the request, if you think about it from a publisher point of view, but that could be of value to everyone, I guess. So it's just prioritizing, really. There's a lot of requests that you get, and as a tech company, you have to make decisions on what you're going to do when and what's the most important. So that's not one that I know is in the immediate roadmap, unfortunately.
So I'll obviously include your contact details for people who want to know more about Kronos Hub. But can you tell me a little bit more about the founders and actually how it started and their background?
Kronos Hub was founded by Christian, who's now the co-CEO at the moment. Kronos Hub is managed by both Christian Grubach and Marianne Knudsen. So they're both co-CEO, and Christian focuses more on the tech side. So he founded Kronos Hub, and originally it was built for the Gates Foundation to manage their APCs. But then we kind of took a direction to cater for publishers as well and institutions, and currently looking at those three different directions, really. Yeah, so it started as a tech startup based in Denmark, quite an international environment. We've got lots of different languages, people from Iceland and Lithuania, and yeah, someone sitting in France, I'm in Scotland. So quite an energetic team, which is nice. So
interesting, a funder helped start the business, or that was the one of the initiators for the business. That's interesting. And where does Kronos Hub see itself in the next few years? Where would it like to be?
I think there's a mission to become thought leaders in open access. We do a lot of initiatives around that. For example, I run monthly webinars where we're trying to really connect people in the community and focus on, you know, bringing publishers and institutions and other technology providers and stakeholders together to have a discussion around that. I think there's also potential you know, to really, yeah, connect the dots. And you think about data coming in from the publishers out to the institutions. I think there's we see it really as a hub that allows that interconnectivity and connecting the different stakeholders. That's really the dream.
There's certainly a lot of work to be done in educating and training, and that outreach and workshops and seminars is so valuable. And I'm still, you know, sometimes slightly astonished about the lack of understanding around open science and open access publishing. The two tend to be conflated. I see open access publishing as one component within the open science ecosystem, which is very, very broad and complex. So, and you have to continue educate and share knowledge and advance to try and progress the ultimate aim of open science, which is to, you know, benefit humanity. And I think it's really important that vendors such as Kronos Hub and others are doing that, because the two, you know, one without the other doesn't really serve your purpose. You know, providing education outreach, sharing knowledge will then advance your business. And those, I think, that have been successful have done that in the last number of years. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, our customer care team also gets a lot of questions from authors. So we do a lot of author engagement. And I recently ran some webinars which were really aimed at researchers to explain, still, because there's still a lot of questions about open access, like what is open access? What are the different journal models? And we did a series of four webinars focused on funders and agreements, and really kind of covering the basics, but as a resource, because we still get so many questions from authors that are confused, and try and take that into account in terms of technology development and try and, you know, automate that. But I you totally agree, a lot of it is still education. And I saw that as well when I worked for IFL. A lot of the work there was around communicating with authors, with libraries, and educating about what is an APC and what is open access.
And in a post-pandemic world now, we're trying to get back to some semblance of normality, particularly attending conferences. Are you planning any conference attendance and presentations where people can meet you, see you over the next year?
Yeah, so I've got a very busy week next week. I'll be at UKSG and then flying from there straight to SSP in Chicago. At UKSG, we've got a booth. There's four of us there, so please stop by. And at SSP is myself and Martin Jagerhorn, the head of business development. We do have a poster presentation, and I'm also on a panel to see about the unusual suspects, which I'm very much looking forward to and very excited about that.
Unfortunately, I'm not going to any of those meetings. I very much like to do that, but we did meet originally at London Book Fair, which was fantastic, I think, just for everybody, with us trying to get back to some normality. But it did emphasize to me the point you made when we were doing, having our briefing call. You did say it's all about the people, and you know, that's absolutely true. And having that ability to meet face to face is still crucially important to try and advance what we're all trying to do together collectively. So I wish you well with your travels, and I will make sure to include links to your presentations and to the Kronos Hub website as well. Do you have any final thoughts on the state of play of scholarly publishing?
No, but like you said, for me, a lot of it is about the people. And I think that's what I liked this industry, and I like to stay in it. People that I've, you know, met and along the way, or that I've met at some point and then get to meet again in a completely different environment. Oh, you already know each other. I really like that. And I'm looking forward to catching up with people face to face. A lot of them, I call them industry colleagues, like people you've gone to conferences together. And maybe you've never done business, but you will at some point, and that's nice, those connections.
Well, Romy, it was very nice to connect with you and meet with you. And thank you for sharing your insights, both on Kronos Hub and your background as well, which is very interesting. We will schedule the meeting sometime next year to come back and review progress with yourself and Kronos Hub. But for the moment, Romy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Martin. Thank you.